Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And this hour, a flip through the pages of the Vonnegut family scrapbook. Some old newsprint clippings from Kurt's early writings, his high school paper, the Shortridge Daily Echo. In college, the Cornell Sun. And then that three-year gap. American infantry private first class Kurt Vonnegut goes to his war. Then back to school and to work. In the scrapbook, bits of newspapers, novels, then the baby pictures. Mark, Edith, Nanette. Later, another photo. Son Mark Vonnegut, now a long-haired hippie beside his VW Beetle, heading west to life in a commune and away from his war. But also prominent in this scrapbook are the sadder stories, memories of mental illness, suicide, depression, drugs, and separation. Stories that fueled the dark, fast humor of Kurt Vonnegut, his own bug house sense of soul-deep fun in this nation's social history. And the noble prose of son Mark detailing his own bad trip from the commune to the padded cell. Connection listeners, to borrow a salutation, welcome to the Monkey House. The Vonnegut family lives and writes its history of mental illness, something that's often celebrated as the inspiration for art, and for most of the rest of us, mental illness lies hidden in those pages of a family album, untreated, unacknowledged. So why is it important to talk about it, to write about it? What can we learn? And do we connect it to chemicals, to society, to war? Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio, the writer and artist Kurt Vonnegut and the writer and now pediatrician Mark Vonnegut. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Kurt, I'm going to start with you because I can't help but in this conversation about mental illness start with your mother's own suicide, Mother's Day, 1944. You're a kid. You're just getting ready to go off to war.
Yes.
And whether or not in your mind that feature of mental illness that keeps coming up in your writing is in any way keyed to that particular event or to what you witnessed as your mother raged through the night with her mental illness.
Well, yeah, I was certainly impressed, as anyone would be, when his or her mother goes completely bananas. Yeah, it just reminded me of how terribly vulnerable we are. Now, Mark's mother, the late Jane Marie Cox, had craziness in her family, and my mother, before displaying how crazy she herself was, told me not to marry Jane Marie Cox, Mark's mother, because there was insanity in that family. And so whatever went wrong with Mark was hereditary.
And did you talk about this, Mark, when you were a kid at home before you headed out to the commune? Did you know these stories of your grandmother railing away from midnight to dawn?
I knew the stories. I thought I was protected from it. I thought that I was stronger. I bought sort of notions that a good education, virtue would protect you from mental illness.
And?
It didn't. Our family, I think, is not very different from other families. If we're different from other families, where it's in that we talk about the mental illness. I think these are very common illnesses. I think they affect families in the arts and families not in the arts. Families in the arts are more likely to be impressed and try to incorporate it into the art. But I think they run through everybody's family.
More than talk about it, though. You both write about it. You write about it. It's in the forefront of the prose that, Kurt, that you've been writing for as long as I've been reading what you've been writing. It's there in Kilgore Trout. It's in all the characters.
Well, I think what Mark is saying, this is simply life, and we don't acknowledge it ordinarily as insanity being an ordinary fraction of most lives.
Do you have a license to write about mental illness and to celebrate it as an artist that people who don't have your stature can't do?
I'm not sure it helps much with creativity. I taught the writer's workshop out at Iowa for a couple of years, and they have an excellent medical school there, and one of the faculty members at the hospital realized that they had a sample of real writers, not would-be writers, but in the faculty of the writer's workshop. Nelson Algren was there when I was there, Jose Donoso, and Vance Bourgeli, and so on. So this woman out there, and I'm sorry, I can't remember her name just now, started interviewing the faculty members, the real writers, in the workshop to find out if there was any common thread. And what she found out, you know, she asked, did you ever go crazy? Did any of your relatives ever go nuts? Now did they go nuts? That sort of thing. She did it for several years after I left. And she found out that writers are largely from families of monopolar depressives and are themselves monopolar depressives. Is how this would help with creativity, I don't know. I think that that writing, if you are good with the language, turns out to be a reasonable treatment for depression.
Treatment for depression?
Yes.
Because you get it out of your system?
Well, who knows? It's another treatment for depression is the blues, and I don't know how that works either.
Mark, your book was published some 17 years ago, The Eden Express. It's being reissued with a foreword by your dad and a new introduction by yourself. And it tells about a time in your life that you're a long way past now. You're a successful doctor. You've got a family. You've got two cars, as your father points out, two kids, two cars. Why go back? Why reissue it? What was it that you wanted to say?
Stuff about the 60s that I think is important is I think that history has been revised to paint hippies and the communes as a mistake, a bunch of drug-addled misfits and stuff. And I think there was a lot positive there. And also to just sort of take some of the shame, blame, and misconceptions away from mental illness. I don't celebrate mental illness. I don't think my father does either. I think we acknowledge it, mm-hmm. and I see it as a worthy opponent, but I don't, it's not to be celebrated.
If my word it's more that there's a certain cachet to saying Van Gogh, yeah, a little bit nuts. Tchaikovsky, mm-hmm. same thing. Beethoven, yeah. Vonnegut, you bet, yeah. You know what I mean? That it's part of the resume.
Right, but if it's a life and death struggle, that I think the difference between somebody like myself that's gone on to have a life worth living and somebody who kills themselves or has break after break or hospitalization after hospitalization has got to be teeny. And so I think, living under that threat, it's different.
Maybe I can get you to read from your book.
Okay.
Something from your time in the hospital. Now, let me set it up for us here. You have gone to the Sunshine Coast, the
right.
west coast of British Columbia. You've
right.
a beautiful home on some 80 acres of land. It's a commune. Things are working out pretty well.
I think we were surprised by how easy it was. I mean, we were expecting to be harder to get shelter, to get food, to find a fertile valley, and things were going very well. But it was a time when I think because of a lot of things that people from our parents' generation were telling us, we were not expecting Western civilization to last very long. And I think they all deny it now, but the truth is we were sent as a generation out into the woods to discover new ways to live as sort of a, like Superman being sent away from Krypton. But and it had gone very well. But then in the middle of all this, I started hearing voices. My world became discontinuous. I would wake up someplace, not know how I got there. I would look at people. They would look like they were somebody. Then they would become that somebody else. If they were sleeping, they looked dead to me. I had to explain a lot in a hurry. And it took a long time for me to get to this place in the book where I realized that where I was a mental hospital.
Go ahead and read from the Eden Express.
There wasn't much to do in the hospital. Most of the time, I just sat around and tried to figure out what had gone wrong. What rotten luck, shitty break. There I was, going along, doing the best I could, and then this happened. Such an impertinence. It was like I was walking through the woods and a tree fell on me and broke my leg. Well, so much for whatever I happened to be doing in the woods. Now I have to deal with the fact that my leg is broken. Unforeseen, unexplained, a detour. Wasn't like that. Had a whole nother flavor. Fit in too well. My craziness had everything to do with what I was doing. When it happened, it was more like I was stumbling along a dark, deserted road trying to get somewhere. Huge mother limousine picked me up, took me where I was going at 100 miles an hour, using shortcuts I hadn't dreamed existed. In the end, I decided I didn't want to be there, but if it weren't for the limousine, I'd probably still be on that road trying to get there. Had farming been what I was really doing, things might have been different. Had clearing land, building a house, getting a place set up for goats and chickens, carving out a home in the wilderness, getting gardens ready to plant, been what I was up to, things might have been turned out differently. There was no way I could have been up to those things, much as I wished I were and tried to make myself be. Let's face it, somebody with a B.A. in religion from Swarthmore, raised upper middle class, intellectual, living in British Columbia, 12 miles by boat from the nearest electric light, has got to be up to something weird. Clearing land, gardening, building the house was all a front. I was into being good, being right, truth, beauty, and saving the world, liberation, enlightenment, and salvation. I was playing for the highest stakes I could find. I had been given all the breaks anyone could ask for and more. Generations had spent their life worrying about money so that I wouldn't have to. I didn't have to do anything, so the only way I could do anything was to do something very, very much worth doing. Worth doing. I was into doing something worth doing.
Mark Vonnegut reading from his book, The Eden Express. Generations had spent their lives worrying about money so that I wouldn't have to. I came across something which Kurt Vonnegut is from a piece of writing that you did after the writing of this book. And you say, if well-educated hippies like Mark, who were in good health and of military age during the Vietnam War, but did not risk their lives and honor in the slaughter, are indeed as scarred as those who fought, their wounds were of a different sort. Chief among these, I will guess, was shame about their membership in a social class, my class, so pandered to by the government that its young, with few exceptions, did not have to go to war if they didn't want to. Were you aware what Mark was going through at the time? Was this something that you felt responsible for?
Well, I think so. What he did was all of a piece with the family and the talk in the family. And yes, is the United States of America had become a disgusting nation, and Mark was clear with the draft and all that. He just didn't want to be an American anymore, and I understood perfectly. Yeah.
Shame about membership in a social class. Did your dad have that right, Mark?
It was, you know, it was where we had come from. I think we felt it was up to us, and in retrospect, I wonder how on earth can you expect people in their early 20s to have a coherent plan of how to save civilization. It wasn't clear to me now. It wasn't clear to me then.
And how on earth can you expect people in their early 20s to stand in a slaughterhouse as you were, what, 23 years old at the time?
Yeah, something like that.
We're going to talk a little bit more about the connection between war, mental illness, writing, and the artist in the studio with me, Kurt and Mark Vonnegut. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. I could spend the rest of the program listing all the things that Kurt Vonnegut has written, but that would be sort of a waste of everybody's time, so I won't do that. Kurt,
I don't see why.
It's not just one big ad, you know. Kurt Vonnegut's in the studio with me. Mark Vonnegut as well. We're talking a little bit about mental illness, the fact that it has figured prominently both in the life and the work of these two people. Kurt, you wrote an introduction for the reissue of yes. Mark's book. Was there a message that you wanted to get across in that? Can I get you to read some of it for
well,
us?
Well, I was very glad that the book, certainly I'll read some. I'm very glad that the book is back in print. And, you know, I get fan mail about as much as Eddie Fisher gets, I think. And one letter in 10 or so will mention Mark. And they are grateful to him for this book because it... You know, as if you're going to go nuts, this is what it's going to be like. And so the book has been extremely helpful, and I think it's a good thing for American civilization to have it available. Yeah, I'll read my foreword. As a movie actor telephoned me a couple of years after this book was published. We had never met, but he knew my son had gone crazy and then recovered. His own son was going crazy, and he was in need of advice. He asked how my son was, and I told him, Mark had just graduated from Harvard Medical School. And he said, some remission. And I said, yes, we were lucky, and I certainly hope you will be too. That was the best I could do back then. That is the best I could do right now. Put another way, some people survived going over Niagara Falls in a barrel. Others didn't. Is it turbulence is really something. Now, my son's, Mark's, he's a hell of a good painter, may I say. But my son Mark's most unsociable performance went bananas, and before I could get him into a Canadian laughing academy, was to babble on, and then wing a cue ball through a picture window in an urban commune in Vancouver, British Columbia. It was only then that his flower children friends telephoned me to say that he was in need of a father. He really threw a cue ball through a picture window. Anyway, God bless telephones. Now, Mark's dear mother, Jane Marie Naycox, now dead, a Quaker, and like Mark, a graduate of the Quaker College, Swarthmore, in Pennsylvania, would often tell him that he was supposed to save the world. His college major had been religion, and he had not yet considered becoming what he has indeed become, a pediatrician. One seeming possibility before he went nuts was that he study for the Unitarian ministry. He was then 22, and I myself was a mere spring chicken of 47, a mere 32 years ago. Let's turn the page here.
It happens with books.
Yes. I took Mark in a... Let's see how it goes here. By the time Mark and I... I went in a hired car from the house with a busted picture window in Vancouver to what turned out to be an excellent private mental hospital in nearby New Westminster. He had at least become a jazz saxophonist and a picture painter. He babbled merrily en route, and it was language, but the words were woven into vocal riffs worthy of his particular hero, John Coltrane. While we awaited Mark's admission in the front lobby of the Canuck Loony Bin, which one has to say had the therapeutically unfortunate name Hollywood Hospital, Mark dug both hands into a big bowl of sand and cigarette butts. When a male nurse appeared to greet us, Mark started painting a picture with his filthy fingers on the bosom of the man's white uniform. The man couldn't have been nicer about it. So Mark eventually recovered his sanity, as, so I am told, the movie actor's son did not. And I recall a time when I pondered buying from a gift shop a pretty object, sacred to believers in a faith I knew nothing about. Only kidding, I asked the woman who waited on me if she thought it would bring me bad luck if I treated it disrespectfully. Only kidding, she replied. That depends, I would think, on how many hostages you have given to fortune. I found her answer so unexpectedly eloquent and poignant that I supposed it to be a quotation. I have since looked it up. It was written by Francis Bacon and reads in full, "He that hath wife and children hath given hostages to fortune." Indeed, indeed. Last summer, I was sitting on the back porch of one of seven hostages I gave to Fortune. This was Mark. This was right before sunset, so all shadows were long. We faced a pleasant but featureless meadow, not all of it his property, bounded by a darkening woodland several hundred yards straight in front of us. And this former hostage, this pediatrician, this saxophonist and painter and writer and chess player and father of two grown sons, said our children, meaning America's children, were in those woods across the meadow there. Mark Vonnegut, M.D., who had to take a lot of pre-med courses before he got into med school, said that children, our children, the country's children, would have to cross that unmarked meadow before they could join us on our porch as grown-ups. He said new technologies had removed all guideposts from the meadow, so it was no longer a simple matter to decide what to do with life, and there were, moreover, landmines between them and us. I said, Doc, you were so crazy a third of a century ago. How come you're so obviously okay now? And he said, my case was a mild one.
Kurt Vonnegut reading the new introduction from his son's book, The Eden Express. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Now, Kurt, in another published essay, you often do this in your books. This is an unpublished essay, and I'm reading it, so it's got to be published. You're writing a foreword, I think, to a book of work by people who were in mental institutions. And you say that nothing left to lose frees people to think their own thoughts, since there's no longer anything to be gained by echoing the thoughts of those around them. Hopelessness is the mother of originality. But the words that stuck out were me that you talk about those people as the world's champions of loneliness. What do you mean by that?
I think that people who recover, as Mark did, have a lot to recover, have a lot to return to. I mean, he had a full life, he had a lot of friends, and he had music and a lot of excitement. And I think that many people who do not recover have nothing to go back to. And so, yes, it is. They are the champions of loneliness. I don't remember having said that, and so I have no idea what I meant.
What about yourself? You fight with depression. You were pumped out and locked up, in the mid-80s at one point?
Well, you needn't tell everybody that.
What? You wrote it.
Yeah. I did attempt to kill myself at one point. and I must say, is one reason not to commit suicide is its descendants thereafter look at suicide as a problem-solving scheme. And what I did write one time is it's any deep puzzle. It will occur to me, well, hey, this is easily fixed, and I recited an algebra problem. You know, a farmer A can harvest 8 pecks of potatoes in 3 hours, and farmer B, who can do, so and so, how long will it take the two of them to make 18 bushels of potatoes? And the answer to that algebra problem is, I think I'll blow my brains out.
In Mark's book, and in your writing about Mark's book, though, you talk about Mark as making it through that episode. I guess what I'm interested in knowing from you is, did you make it through that one episode, or do you still flirt with depression?
Oh, I still do, but it's helpful to know what it is. And to know that it's not a friend. But I must say, there is one kind of depression, which I'm experiencing this morning after the election, which is existential depression, which has no chemical basis whatsoever.
You didn't vote for the Republicans.
I am afraid that I am like Joe Heller. Just I don't vote anymore, and that is terrible, and I don't recommend that to anybody. Joe Heller never voted.
Why?
He didn't want to be complicit.
I want to go to calls, but Mark, just before I do, I want to just a follow-up from you on what I'm talking about with Kurt here in terms of his own depression. You know, he's talking about you can inherit the likelihood of suicide. Is this something that you think about as well, that you sort of need to keep an eye on the old man?
It's something I grew up with as a worry, but I think that's I don't worry about him anymore. But part of what I thought I had accomplished by going crazy is I felt that my father was about to kill himself, and I had to break certain physical laws to slap the gun out of his hand and keep him on the planet. And you can still not prove to me that I didn't do that. But I think, in terms of who gets better and who doesn't, I think you look in retrospect. I remember I had 3 quick episodes in spite of medication, in spite of being in a hospital, and people were looking at my childhood and my socialization as pretty marginal. Now, once I go through medical school, it looks like I had a pretty good pre-morbid adjustment, as they say. But I think that you look in retrospect, and I also know from my mail that there are a lot of people who were very, very crazy, recovered just as thoroughly as I have, and they mostly, and probably wisely, keep their mouths shut about it.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Crusoe, North Carolina, and Strother's on the line. Hi, Strother.
Hi. First of all, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a sort of related story. My father, who has he passed on when I was 6 years old, Jim Stingley, he was a journalist for the L.A. Times, actually twice nominated for Pulitzer. He suffered from depression severely, and it, combined with his alcoholism and weight and so forth, took his life at age 42. And I just wanted to make the point that there really is a fine line between the quote-unquote insanity, firing your passion, and ending your life. I do end up living in fear that I follow in my father's footsteps, but luckily I think I have a little bit more stable footing. I just wanted to congratulate the Vonneguts in not only keeping alive and keeping well and obviously with good humor, but those are some good books out there too.
Yeah. Anything for Strother, gentlemen?
It's just, you know, just another family dealing with mental illness. Don't, you know. Yeah. I think once you realize it's in your family or you realize it's in you and you figure out how to take good care of your illness, the things I do and did, from the time I was sick to stay well have served me well. You know, if you take good care of a mild heart attack, you live a good life.
May I interject?
Yeah.
I believe that, and I, like I said, you have a wonderful sense of humor, both of you. I want to say that it's one of the strongest tools for getting through the hardest times in life.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Yeah, it seems to me that, the correlation between being depressive and being an artist is, I think you've accidentally discovered a treatment for depression in the practice of an art. That's how it becomes a correlation, is you find something that can help as a practice of an art. But I know that, Al Murray wrote, he was a jazz historian and all, and he was talking about the suicide rate among slave owners was much higher than the suicide rate among slaves. And Murray thought the reason was that the slaves had discovered a specific remedy for depression, and the whites had no way to deal with it, and the black way of dealing with it, the African American way of dealing with it, was the blues. And I must say that growing up in Indianapolis, as I went and listened to African American music, and man, it helped me a lot too.
Strother,
still does.
Thanks for your call, Strother. We're at 1-800-423-8255 to Foxborough, Massachusetts. Cindy's joining us. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. My husband died on September 11th in the terrorist attacks, and I have a 9-year-old son who is currently hospitalized for what they're saying is a mood disorder with a depressive anxiety underlay. And that being said, he has always been a very creative child. He's always been very artistic. He never walks around without a book in his hand or a piece of paper and is writing constantly. He's come up with very elaborate plans to capture Osama bin Laden that, you know, you look at them and it's from the eyes of a child, but they're very detailed and elaborate and creative. And I'm wondering what, since I want this to be his first and only hospitalization, I never want to have to go through this again. How can you tap into that creativity to make that work for you? And what did Mark do and Kurt do to avoid Mark going, cycling through hospital after hospital after hospital?
Mark.
I think some of it was luck. I mean, that I didn't, I think that, you know, and I hope your son's creativity will help him. And I think when, you know, part of me in the big picture says, well, why if these illnesses are so dreadful, why haven't, and they're genetic, why haven't they been bred out of the population? And these affective disorders, they have to have a positive survival value. And I think some forms of creativity or making unusual connections or thinking outside the box or something really gives you a way to survive, but it also, it seems to make you vulnerable. I think I was so terrified of going crazy. I had three episodes in a row in the hospital, and I just felt like I was cooked and that was going to be my life. And so I worked really hard in terms of, you know, diet, exercise. They gave me a lot of vitamins at the time, which I don't think had much to do with it. But, I had a compass in life, which is I don't want to go back into the damn hospital. And so if I noticed that certain friends or whatever or activities was helpful, I use my compass. And I think your son hopefully will get a compass too.
Cindy, I want to thank you for your call. Our best wishes to your boy. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Taking a short break, back with father and son, Kurt and Mark Vonnegut, talking a little bit about politics, war, mental illness, here in The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up,
you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, Kurt Vonnegut, Mark Vonnegut, talking about their writing, the family history of mental illness, and a little bit about artistic coping with that. 1-800-423-8255. To Brighton, Massachusetts, Richard's joining us. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
I'm big fans of both. Let me ask this. Does Mark or did Kurt ever consider that the madness, insanity beyond words that Kurt Vonnegut saw in Dresden was somehow passed along to Mark as though it were genetic, and that might have contributed to his episode? And secondly, did Mark ever consider his episodes were a way of coping with his father's celebrity and his mother's incantation to save the world?
Kurt, let's start with you, whether or not what happened in Schlachtoffunf?
Yeah, I would think not. And certainly I wasn't. How many of us were in the Second World War? How many Americans? I think on the order of 30 million, maybe. And so we all had war stories. I think by and large we were largely envied for having been in a war and having survived.
But you put yourself in a very specific cultural place with the publication of Slaughterhouse-Five, mm-hmm. in that you spoke not just for the generation of the Second World War, but you wrote it and published it at a time when it was particularly penetrating to people who were looking at the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
At the same time. So, I mean,
well, the The subtitle was actually the key to the book, which is The Children's Crusade. And when Slaughterhouse-Five was published, as young people were saying to me, Dad said the war wasn't like that at all. You know, Dad liked to imagine that he was Frank Sinatra, you know, or Duke Wayne with a submachine gun and throwing. And
the Children's Crusade.
Dad was a little kid, and not a man at all. And so, yeah, I think it was helpful to acknowledge yet again that it was children who fight wars.
And a promise that you made to Mary O'Hare that you wouldn't glorify it, Mary O'Hare being the wife of one of the people who was with you in Slaughterhouse 5. Not going to glorify it. Mark, what about your sense of in response to Richard here, of trying to figure out?
One of the things that happens when somebody has a psychotic break is is there are an awful lot of explanations. And my father's celebrity status, the times in general, living on a commune, there's the Freudian interpretations, and on and on and on. And I felt like telling people to take a number because it were – and I now – what I truly believe is that what I have is – it was diagnosed at the time as schizophrenia. They changed the definitions and now be classified as a manic depressive because I got better. In any event, I think that my stress tolerance was going to deteriorate and deteriorate and deteriorate. And whether I was in New York City or a commune, at about some point in my early 20s, with the stress as people say, it must be hard. Your father is a celebrity. And I feel like saying, well, is your father a complete failure? That can't be easy. I mean, you know, there were so many explanations, they can't all, you know, I tended to just sort of throw them away and say, I don't want any, and also for getting better. If it's a biochemical genetic disorder, which I believe it is, then I don't get credit for being brave and courageous. I get credit for having a mild case, having my neurons in a slightly better position and taking my meds.
What you haven't mentioned, which is an extraordinary event, you were giving up your nation. That is really quite something to do. He was giving up America, and he was going to become a landed immigrant in Canada.
I did, in fact, become a landed immigrant. I didn't see it as giving. I saw it as doing the next right thing towards trying to find a way where I could live. And I did think at the time I confused mental illness with virtue, in that my inability to tolerate rush hour traffic, my inability to tolerate loud noises and to become more and more sensitive, which I now see as part of mental illness, I saw as virtue. And I saw that if the generals and leaders could be as sensitive as I was, they would vomit before they could bomb people. Oversimplification. But I really do think that mental illness happens and people interpret, and the interpretations are usually not a lot better than tea leaves.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for your call, Richard. 1-800-423-8255. To Appleton, Wisconsin, Jay's joining us. Hi, Jay. Jay, are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, first I'd like to say hi to Kurt and Mark. Kurt, I've been a big fan of yours for... 15 years now. I've read everything I can get my hands on. And I wanted to send out a special thank you to you because in trying to cope with my mother's mental illness, she would go crazy in the middle of the night, just about every single night. Reading your autobiographies gave me a lot of strength to recognize. And Mark mentioned earlier, it is helpful to know what it is. And having read your work really gave me the strength to make it through. My mom has since passed on, but you really gave me the strength when I needed it, and I just wanted to thank you.
You must be really strong.
Why do you say that?
He had a worse time than I did. It's very rarely that mother didn't do it night after night. I think she only did it about once a month.
Well, there was never a dull moment.
Yeah. Tell me something, Jay, that when you talk about Kurt's writing as being autobiographically somewhat useful, I was never sure first time through this stuff how much of it was autobiographical, how much of it was just coming from a sort of twisted mind.
Well, I guess when you grow up with insanity, they're one and the same to you. that may be a stretch, but I reading Fate's Worse Than Death and subsequent books, that's what I mean by autobiographical.
Yeah.
And just hearing Kurt or reading Kurt talk about growing up in that setting and how he's dealt with it himself and reading about his relationship with his son has been comforting to me and has given me strength.
Did you intend your collection of, excuse me, Kurt, your collection of essays and speeches that you'd made to people to be useful, to be instructive in the way that it was to Jay? Was that part of the exercise?
I don't think you can plan that carefully. You simply write what you must write, and sometimes there is a very gratifying response, as it turns out. But again, I've gotten letters about Mark saying his book had been so helpful to them, as they went nuts or felt as though they were going nuts. So, no, it's just luck.
I said earlier in the program, Mark, that it was 17 years ago. It was 27 years ago when it was first published, 75, right?
Right.
And do you still get feedback from people about it?
I do.
Are they writing to you as a doctor or as a recovered sufferer of mental illness?
Lunatic.
Don't mess around with words. Say what's really on your mind.
No, it's you know, I love the mail. The mail is mostly very positive. It's a selected group that is, you know, recovered well enough to write a coherent letter. So I do tend to hear a lot of very positive stories of people who went through various forms of mental illness and are living life.
I'm interested in hearing from both of you, though, about the connection between war and the state of a nation and the state of the mental health of the mm-hmm. people who inhabit the nation, because that's the continuum here. That, Kurt, it's your time in your war, the Second World War, and Mark, it's your time not going to your war, the Vietnam War. And I was, you know, this is so much in the air today. I thought that I'd ask you both to try and give a sense of what the connection is between your state of mind and what's going on in the country. Mark, do you want to start?
I think we felt, you know, that we had to do something extraordinary in view of the war. I think in World War II, it was much more, you know, they had to do something extraordinary to, you know, in the Second World War to save the world. And I think to be called to a great battle the way I think we were against a war is sort of a defining moment. And I sometimes think I bore my children. I actually have a 4-month-old son now, too. But I have a 25 and a 21-year-old, and I don't want their eyes to glaze over and say, oh, Dad's talking about what he did in his 20s again. I think that people do tend to define themselves by the battle that happened in their 20s. And I do think that, you know, manic depression or mental illness does, it has a positive effect in that it's like putting a supercharger on your brain for a little while. And I think that people, it's like a form of adrenaline. It certainly has its downside too, but I think, and I think people now are going to, I mean, there's a lot of you know, if we go to war against Iraq or whatever, then people in their 20s are going to define themselves by how they respond to that. I find it such a great relief to be a pediatrician who deals with the child in front of me and trying to figure out what's wrong with them and what I should do about it, because it's certainly stressful at times, but it's restful compared to trying to figure out what to do about Western civilization.
Kurt, I was thinking of what's coming up in Iraq yesterday when I was reading through some of your writing, and you made a speech to someone and said, what can I accomplish but a decrease in American happiness if I say to a crowd as I did that an attack on a civilian population by clean, decent young men in enormously expensive and complex flying machines is, when viewed from the ground, no different from the practice of the world's worst police departments, which is to make arrested nobodies watch the torture of innocent friends and relatives. Yeah. I put that down. I looked at the newspaper, and there's a story about remote-controlled predators firing hellfire missiles from planes that don't even have people in them. And
yes, and of course, that is the motive of the anti-war protest now, is not that we are going to take casualties, which we will, but that we are... It's quite customary for us to kill, you know, maybe 10 or 20 or 100 men, women, and children in the process of going after a bad guy. And actually, George Bush Sr. did this in Panama, really, as he realized how crazy it was. We went down there and arrested a head of state because he was dealing drugs. But
it was regime change. Come on.
Yes, but in the process, we blew up some slums and poor neighborhoods and that. And I forget, I used to know how many people were killed, 1,600, something like that.
And now when people talk about the possibility of changing the leader of Iraq, they talk about the possibility of sending American soldiers through the streets of Baghdad.
Yes, but what the hawks want to say about the anti-war people, me, Howard Zinn, and so forth, is that, you know, we're cowardly. We don't want to take any losses, and we don't want to inflict so much butchery it's hell. Howard Zinn was a bombardier, and I was the bombed in the Second World War. And we were honored to be there. And yes, there are times when America should be ready to take casualties, but the number of civilians we kill is never commented on. And of course, that's a nasty thing for a country to do.
You're going to be 80 years old on Monday.
That's not true. No, and what it's like to be this old is I can't parallel park worth a damn anymore.
You said when you were 50 years old that most artists were done what they were doing when they were 50, and here you are still at it.
Well, I'm just simply alive. It's I'm not all that productive anymore. And I know it's caused a lot of heartbreak when I've said I'm not going to write any more books, and actually I didn't expect to live this long, but I am shopping around a book now, and it's purely autobiographical. It's about my love affair with O.J. Simpson.
You're going to come clean finally, are you?
Well, he was still playing for the Bills at the time, and they were playing the Pats, and so I went to the dressing room after the game and asked him to autograph my football, and I didn't realize that was code.
Thank you so much for coming in, Kurt and Mark Vonnegut. Fascinating to have you in the Connection studio. Come back sometime, will you?
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is WBUR.